content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the May 22, 1978 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Moons of Jupiter, by Alice Munro. I found my father in the heart wing on the 8th floor of Toronto General Hospital. He was in a semi-private room. The other bed was empty. He said that his hospital insurance covered only a bed in the ward, and he was worried that he might be charged extra. "I never asked for a semi-private," he said. I said, "The wards are probably full." "No, I saw some empty beds when they were wheeling me by." "Then it was because you had to be hooked up to that thing," I said. "Don't worry. If they're going to charge you extra, they'll tell you about it."
"That's likely it," he said. "They wouldn't want those doohickeys set up in the wards. I guess I'm covered for that kind of thing."
I said I was sure he was. He had wires taped to his chest. A small screen hung over his head. On the screen, a bright, jagged line was continually being written. The writing was accompanied by a nervous electronic beeping. The behavior of his heart was on display. I tried to ignore it. It seemed to me that paying such close attention, in fact, dramatizing what ought to be a most secret activity, was asking for trouble. Anything exposed that way was apt to flare up and go crazy. My father did not seem to mind. He said they had him on tranquilizers. You know, he said, the happy pills. He did seem calm and optimistic. It had been a different story the night before. When I brought him into the hospital to the emergency room, he had been pale and closed-mouthed. He had opened the car door and stood up and said quietly, "Maybe you better get me one of those wheelchairs." He used the voice he always used in a crisis. Once our chimney caught on fire, it was on a Sunday afternoon, and I was in the dining room pinning together a dress I was making. He came in and said in that same matter-of-fact warning voice, "Janet, do you know where there's some baking powder?" Afterward, he said, "I guess it was your fault, sewing on Sunday." I had to wait for over an hour in the emergency waiting room. They summoned a heart specialist who was in the hospital, a young man. He called me out into the hall and explained to me that one of the valves of my father's heart had deteriorated so badly that there ought to be an immediate operation. I asked him what would happen otherwise. "Well, he'd have to stay in bed," the doctor said.
"How long?"
"Oh, maybe 3 months."
I meant, how long would he live?"
"Well, that's what I meant, too," the doctor said. I went to see my father. He was sitting up in bed in a curtained-off corner. "It's bad, isn't it?" he said. "Did he tell you about the valve?"
"It's not as bad as it could be," I said. Then I repeated, even exaggerated, anything hopeful the doctor had said. "You're not in any immediate danger. Your physical condition is good, otherwise."
"Otherwise," said my father gloomily. I was tired from the drive, all the way to Dalgleish to get him, and back to Toronto since noon, and worried about getting the rented car back on time, and irritated by an article I'd been reading in a magazine in the waiting room. It was about another painter, a woman younger, better looking, probably more talented than I am. I had been in England for 2 months, and so I had not seen this article before, but it crossed my mind while I was reading that my father would have. I could hear him saying, "Well, I didn't see anything about you in McLean's," and if he had read something about me, he would say, "Well, I didn't think too much of that write-up." His tone would be humorous and indulgent, but would produce in me a familiar dreariness of spirit. The message I got from him was simple. Fame must be striven for, then apologized for. Getting or not getting it, you will be to blame. I was not surprised by the doctor's news. I was prepared to hear something of the sort and was pleased with myself for taking it calmly, just as I would be pleased with myself for dressing a wound or looking down from the frail balcony of a high building. I thought, yes, it's time. There has to be something. Here it is.
I did not feel any of the protest I would have felt 20, even 10 years before. When I saw from my father's face that he felt it, that refusal leapt up in him as readily as if he had been 30 or 40 years younger, my heart hardened, and I spoke with a kind of badgering cheerfulness. "Otherwise is plenty," I said. The next day, he was himself again. That was how I would have put it. He said it appeared to him now that the young fella, the doctor, might have been a bit too eager to operate. "A bit knife-happy," he said. He was both mocking and showing off the hospital slang. He said that another doctor had examined him, an older man, and had given it as his opinion that rest and medication might do the trick. I didn't ask what trick. "He says I've got a defective valve, all right. There's certainly some damage. They wanted to know if I had rheumatic fever when I was a kid, and I said I didn't think so, but, yeah, half the time then you weren't diagnosed what you had." My father was not one for getting the doctor. The thought of my father's childhood, which I always pictured as bleak and dangerous, the poor farm, the scared sisters, the harsh father, made me less resigned to his dying. I thought of him running away to work on the lake boats, running along the railroad tracks toward Goodrich in the evening light. He used to tell about that trip. Somewhere along the track he found a quince tree. Quince trees are rare in our part of the country. In fact, I have never seen one. Not even the one my father found, though he once took us on an expedition to look for it. He thought he knew the crossroad it was near, but we couldn't find it. He had not been able to eat the fruit, of course, but had been impressed by its existence. It made him think he had got into a new part of the world. The escaped child, the survivor, an old man trapped here by his leaky heart. I didn't pursue these thoughts. I didn't care to think of his younger selves. Even his bare torso, thick and white, he had the body of a working man of his generation, seldom exposed to the sun, was a danger to me. It looked so strong and young. The wrinkled neck, the age, freckled hands and arms, the narrow, courteous head with its thin gray hair and mustache were more what I was used to. "Now, why would I want to get myself operated on?" said my father reasonably. "Think of the risk at my age, and what for? A few years at the outside? I think the best thing for me to do is go home and take it easy. Give in gracefully. That's all you can do at my age. Your attitude changes, you know. You go through some mental changes. It seems more natural." "What does?" I said. "Well, death does. You can't get more natural than that. No, what I mean specifically is not having the operation." "That seems more natural?" "Yes." "It's up to you," I said, but I did approve. This was what I would have expected of him. Whenever I told people about my father, I stressed his independence, his self-sufficiency, his forbearance. He worked in a factory. He worked in his garden. He read history books. He could tell you about the Roman emperors or the Balkan Wars. He never made a fuss. Judith, my younger daughter, had come to meet me at Toronto Airport 2 days before. She had brought the boy she was living with, whose name was Don. They were driving to Mexico in the morning, and while I was in Toronto, I was to stay in their apartment. For the time being, I lived in Vancouver. I sometimes say that I have my headquarters in Vancouver. "Where's Nicola?" I said, thinking at once of an accident or an overdose. Nicola is my older daughter. She used to be a student at the conservatory, and then she became a cocktail waitress, and then she was out of work. If she had been at the airport, I would probably have said something wrong. I would have asked her what her plans were, and she would have gracefully brushed back her hair and said, "Plans?" as if that was a word I had invented. "I knew the first thing you'd say would be about Nicola," Judith said. "It wasn't. I said hello, and I..." We'll get you back," Don said neutrally. "Is she all right?" "I'm sure she is," said Judith, with a fabricated air of amusement. "You wouldn't look like that if I was the one who wasn't here." "Of course I would." "You wouldn't. Nicholas, the baby of the family, you know. She's 4 years older than I am. Well, I ought to know. Judith said she did not know where Nicola was exactly. She said Nicola had moved out of her apartment, that dump, and had actually telephoned, which is quite a deal, you might say, Nicola phoning, to say she wanted to be incommunicado for a while, but she was fine. I told her you would worry, said Judith more kindly on the way to their van. Don walked ahead carrying my suitcase. But don't, she's all right, believe me. Don's presence made me uncomfortable. I did not like him to hear these things. I thought of the conversations they must have had, Don and Judith, or Don and Judith and Nicola, for Nicola and Judith were sometimes on good terms, or Don and Judith and Nicola and others whose names I did not even know. They would have talked about me, Judith and Nicola, comparing notes, relating anecdotes, analyzing, regretting, blaming, forgiving. I wished I'd had a boy and a girl, or two boys. They wouldn't have done that. Boys couldn't possibly know so much about you. And I did the same thing at that age. When I was the age Judith is now, I talked with my friends in the college cafeteria or late at night over coffee in our cheap rooms. And when I was the age Nicola is now, I had Nicola herself in a Caricot squirming in my lap, and I was drinking coffee again all the rainy Vancouver afternoons with my one neighborhood friend, Ruth Boudreau, who read a lot and was bewildered by her situation, as I was. We talked about our parents, our childhoods, though for some time we kept clear of our marriages. How thoroughly we dealt with our fathers and mothers, deplored their marriages, their mistaken ambitions or fear of ambition. How competently we filed them away, defined them beyond any possibility of change. What presumption! I looked at Don walking ahead. A tall, ascetic-looking boy with a St. Francis cap of black hair, a precise fringe of beard. What right did he have to hear about me, to know things I myself had probably forgotten? I decided that his beard and hairstyle were affected. Once, when my children were little, my father said to me, "You know those years you were growing up? Well, that's all just a kind of a blur to me. I can't sort out one year from another." I was offended. I remembered each separate year with pain and clarity. I could have told how old I was when I went to look at the evening dresses in the window of Benbow's Ladies' Wear. Every week through the winter, a new dress, spotlit, the sequins and tulle, the rose and lilac, sapphire, daffodil, and me a cold worshipper on the slushy sidewalk. I could have told how old I was when I forged my mother's signature on a bad report card, when I had measles, when we papered the front room. But the years when Judith and Nicola were little, when I lived with their father, yes, blur is the word for it. I remember hanging out diapers, bringing in and folding diapers. I can recall the kitchen counters of two houses and where the clothes basket sat. I remember the television programs, Popeye the Sailor, The Three Stooges, Funorama. When Funorama came on, it was time to turn on the lights and cook supper. But I couldn't tell the years apart. We lived outside Vancouver in a dormitory suburb. Dormier, dormer, dormouse, something like that. I was sleepy all the time then. Pregnancy made me sleepy. And the night feedings and the West Coast rain falling, dark dripping cedars, shiny dripping laurel, wives yawning, napping, visiting, drinking coffee and folding diapers. Husbands coming home at night from the city across the water. Every night I kissed my homecoming husband in his wet Burberry, and hoped he might wake me up. I served up meat and potatoes and one of the four vegetables he permitted. He ate with a violent appetite and then fell asleep on the living room sofa. We had become a cartoon couple, more middle-aged in our 20s than we would be in middle age. Those bumbling years are the years our children will remember all their lives. Corners of the yards I never visited will stay in their heads. "Did Nicola want to see me?" I said to Judith. "She doesn't want to see anybody half the time," she said. Judith moved ahead and touched Don's arm. I knew that touch, an apology, an anxious reassurance. You touch a man that way to remind him that you're grateful, that you realize he is doing for your sake something that bores him or slightly endangers his dignity. It made me feel older than grandchildren would to see my daughter touch a man, a boy, this way. I felt her sad jitters, could predict her supple attentions. My blunt and stocky, blonde and candid child. Why should I think she wouldn't be susceptible, that she would always be straightforward, heavy-footed, self-reliant? Just as I go around saying that Nicola is sly and solitary, cold and seductive, many people must know things that would contradict what I say. In the morning, Don and Judith left for Mexico. I decided I wanted to see somebody who wasn't related to me and who didn't expect anything in particular from me. I called an old lover of mine, but his phone was answered by a machine. "This is Tom Shepherd speaking. I'll be out of town for the month of September. Please record your message, name, and phone number." Tom's voice sounded so pleasant and familiar that I opened my mouth to ask him the meaning of this foolishness. Then I hung up. I felt as if he had deliberately let me down, as if we had planned to meet in a public place and then he hadn't shown up. Once he had done that, I remembered. I got myself a glass of vermouth, though it was not yet noon, and I phoned my father. "Well, of all things," he said, 15 more minutes and you would have missed me." "Were you going downtown?" "Downtown Toronto." He explained that he was going to the hospital. His doctor in Dalgleish wanted the doctors in Toronto to take a look at him, and he had given him a letter to show them in the emergency room. "Emergency room?" I said. "It's not an emergency. He just seems to think that this is the best way to handle it. He knows the name of the fellow there, and if he was to make me an appointment, it might take weeks." "Does your doctor know you're driving to Toronto?" I said.
"Well, he didn't say I couldn't."
The upshot of this was that I rented a car, drove to Dalgleish, brought my father back to Toronto, and had him in the emergency room by 7 o'clock that evening. Before Judith left, I said to her, "You're sure Nicola knows I'm staying here?" "Well, I told her," she said. Sometimes the phone rang, but it was always a friend of Judith's. "Well, looks like I'm going to have it," my father said. This was on the fourth day. He had done a complete turnaround overnight. "It looks like I might as well." I didn't know what he wanted me to say. I thought perhaps he looked to me for a protest, an attempt to dissuade him. "Well, when will they do it?" I said. "Day after tomorrow." I said I was going to the washroom. I went to the nurse's station and found a woman there who I thought was the head nurse. At any rate, she was gray-haired, kind, and serious-looking. "My father's having an operation day after tomorrow," I said. "Oh, yes. I just wanted to talk to somebody about it. I thought there'd been a sort of decision reached that he'd be better not to. I thought because of his age." "Well, you know, it's his decision and the doctor's." And she smiled at me without condescension. "It's hard to make these decisions." "How were his tests?" "Well, I haven't seen them all." I was sure she had. After a moment, she said, "We have to be realistic, but the doctors here are very good." When I went back into the room, my father said in a surprised voice, "Shoreless seas." "What?" I said. I wondered if he had found out how much or how little time he could hope for. I wondered if the pills had brought on an untrustworthy euphoria, or if he had wanted to gamble. Once when he was talking to me about his life, he said, "The trouble was I was always afraid to take chances." I used to tell people that he never spoke regretfully about his life, but that was not true. It was just that I didn't listen to it. He said that he should have gone into the army as a tradesman. He would have been better off. He said he should have gone on his own as a carpenter after the war. He should have got out of Dalgleish. Once he said, "A wasted life, eh?" But he was making fun of himself, saying that because it was such a dramatic thing to say. When he quoted poetry, too, he always had a scoffing note in his voice to excuse the showing off and the pleasure. "Shoreless seas," he said again. "Behind him lay the gray Azores, behind the gates of Hercules. Before him, not the ghost of shores, before him only shoreless seas." That's what was going through my head last night. But do you think I could remember what kind of seas? I could not. Lonely seas, empty seas? I was on the right track, but I couldn't get it. But there now, when you came into the room and I wasn't thinking about it at all, the word popped into my head. That's always the way, isn't it? It's not all that surprising. I asked my mind a question. The answer's there, but I can't see all the connections my mind's making to get to it. Like a computer. Nothing out of the way, you know. In my situation, the thing is, if there's anything you can't explain right away, there's a great temptation to, well, to make a mystery out of it. There's a great temptation to believe in, you know, the soul, I said, speaking lightly, feeling an appalling rush of love and recognition. Oh, I guess you could call it that. You know, when I first came into this room, there was a pile of papers here by the bed. Somebody had left them here, one of these tabloid sort of things I never looked at. And I started reading them. I mean, I'll read anything handy. And there was a series running in them on personal experiences of people who had died, medically speaking, heart arrest mostly, and had been brought back to life. It was what they remembered of the time when they were dead, their experiences. "Pleasant, Aura," I said. "Oh, pleasant. Oh, yes." They'd float up to the ceiling and look down on themselves and see the doctors working on them and on their bodies. And then they float on further and recognize some people they knew who had died before them. Not see them exactly, but sort of sense them. Sometimes there would be a humming and sometimes a sort of, what's that light that there is a color around a person? Aura? Yes, but without the person. That's about all they'd get time for. And then they found themselves back in the body and feeling all the mortal pain and so on, brought back to life. Did it seem convincing? I don't know. It's all in whether you want to believe that kind of thing or not. And if you're going to believe it, take it seriously. I figure you got to take everything else seriously that they print in those papers. Well, what else do they? Rubbish. Cancer cures, baldness cures, belly aching about the younger generation and the welfare bombs. Tripe about movie stars. Oh, yes, I know. In my situation, you have to keep a watch, he said, or you'll start playing tricks on yourself. And then he said, there's a few practical details we ought to get straight on. And he told me about his will, the house, and the cemetery plot. Everything was simple. You want me to phone Peggy? I said. Peggy's my sister. She's married to an astronomer and lives in Victoria. He thought about it. I guess we ought to tell them, he said finally, but tell them not to get alarmed. All right. No, wait a minute. Sam is supposed to be going to a conference the end of this week, and Peggy was planning to go along with him. I don't want them wondering about changing their plans. Where's the conference? Amsterdam, he said proudly. He did take pride in Sam and kept track of his books and articles. He would pick one up and say, look at that, will you? And I can't understand a word of it. In a marveling voice, it managed nevertheless to have a trace of ridicule. Professor Sam, he would say, and the three little Sams. This is what he called his grandsons, who did resemble their father in braininess and in an almost endearing pushiness, an innocent, energetic showing off. They went to a private school that favored old-fashioned discipline and started calculus in grade 5. And the dogs, he might enumerate further, who would have been to obedience school, and Peggy. But if I said, do you suppose she has been to obedience school too? He would play the game no further. I imagine that when he was with Sam and Peggy, he spoke of me in the same way. Hinted at my flightiness, just as he hinted at their stodginess, made mild jokes at my expense, did not quite conceal his amazement or pretended not to conceal his amazement that people paid money for things I had painted. He had to do this so that he might never seem to brag, but he would put up the gates when the joking got too rough, and of course I found later in the house things of mine he had kept, a few drawings, things I had never bothered about. Now his thoughts traveled from Peggy's family to mine. "Have you heard from Judith?" he said. "Not yet." "Well, it's pretty soon. Were they going to sleep in the van?" "Yes." "I guess it's safe enough if they stop in the right places." I knew he would have to say something more, and I knew it would come out as a joke. "I guess they put a board down in the middle like the pioneers." I smiled but did not answer. "I take it you have no objections?" "No," I said. "Well, I always believe that, too. Keep out of your children's business. I tried not to say anything. I never said anything when you left Richard."
"What do you mean, said anything? Criticize?"
"It wasn't any of my business."
"No."
"But that doesn't mean I was pleased." I was surprised, not just at what he said, but at his feeling that he had any right, even now, to say it. I had to look out the window and down at the traffic to control myself. "I just wanted you to know," he added. A long time ago, he said to me in his mild way, "It's funny. Richard, when I first saw him, reminded me of what my father used to say. He'd say that if that fellow was half as smart as he thinks he is, he'd be twice as smart as he really is." I turned to remind him of this, but found myself looking at the line his heart was writing. Not that there seemed to be anything wrong, any difference in the beeps and points, but it was there. He saw where I was looking. "Unfair advantage," he said. "It is," I said. "I'm going to have to get hooked up, too." We left. We kissed formally. I left. At least he hadn't asked me about Nicola, I thought. The next afternoon, I didn't go to the hospital because my father was having some more tests done to prepare for the operation. I was to see him in the evening instead. I found myself wandering through the Bloor Street dress shops trying on clothes. A preoccupation with fashion and my own appearance had descended on me like a raging headache. I looked at the women in the street, at the clothes in the shops, trying to discover how a transformation might be made, what I would have to buy. I recognized this obsession for what it was, but had trouble shaking it. I've had people tell me that waiting for life or death news, they've stood in front of an open refrigerator eating anything in sight. Cold boiled potatoes, chili sauce, bowls of whipped cream, or have been unable to stop doing crossword puzzles. Attention narrows in on something. Some distraction grabs on, becomes fanatically serious. I shuffled clothes on the rack, pulled them on in hot little changing rooms in front of cruel mirrors. I was sweating. Once or twice I thought I might faint. Out on the street again, I thought I must remove myself from Bloor Street, and decided to go to the museum. I remembered another time in Vancouver. It was when Nicola was going to kindergarten and Judith was a baby. Nicola had been to the doctor about a cold, or maybe for a routine examination, and the blood test revealed something about her white blood cells, either that there were too many of them or that they were enlarged. The doctor ordered further tests, and I took Nicola to the hospital for them. Nobody mentioned leukemia, but I knew, of course, what they were looking for. When I took Nicola home, I asked a babysitter, who had been with Judith, to stay for the afternoon, and I went shopping. I bought the most daring dress I ever owned, a black silk sheath with some laced-up arrangement in front. I remembered that bright spring afternoon, the spike-heeled shoes in the department store, the underwear printed with leopard spots. I also remembered going home from St. Paul's Hospital, over the Lions Gate Bridge on the crowded bus and holding Nicola on my knee. She suddenly recalled her baby name for Bridge and whispered to me, "Wee! Over the wee!" I did not avoid touching my child. Nicola was slender and graceful even then, with a pretty black and fine dark hair, but realized I was touching her with a difference. though I did not think it could ever be detected. There was a care, not a withdrawal exactly, but a care, not to feel anything much. I saw how the forms of love might be maintained with a condemned person, but with the love disciplined, because you have to survive. It could be done so discreetly that the object of such care would not suspect, any more than she would suspect the sentence of death itself. Nicola did not know, would not know. Toys and kisses and jokes would come tumbling over her. She would never know, though I worried that she would feel the wind between the cracks of the manufactured normal days. But all was well. Nicola did not have leukemia. She grew up, was still alive, and possibly happy, incommunicado. I could not think of anything in the museum I really wanted to see, so I walked past it to the planetarium. I had never been to a planetarium. The show was due to start in 10 minutes. I went inside, bought a ticket, got in line. There was a whole class of school children, maybe a couple of classes, with teachers and volunteer mothers riding herd on them. I looked around to see if there were any other unattached adults. Only one. A man with a red face and puffy eyes, who looked as if he might be here to keep himself from going to a bar. Inside, we sat on wonderfully comfortable seats that were tilted back so you lay in a sort of hammock, attention directed to the bowl of the ceiling, which soon turned dark blue, with a faint rim of light all around the edge. There was some splendid, commanding music. The adults all around were shushing the children, trying to make them stop crackling their potato chip bags. Then a man's voice, an eloquent professional voice, began to speak slowly out of the walls. The voice reminded me a little of the way radio announcers used to introduce a piece of classical music or describe the progress of the royal family to Westminster Abbey on one of their royal occasions. There was a faint echo chamber effect. The dark ceiling was filling with stars. They came out not all at once, but one after another, the way the stars really do come out at night, though more quickly. The Milky Way appeared, was moving closer. Stars swam into brilliance and kept on going, disappearing beyond the edges of the sky screen or behind my head. While the flow of light continued, the voice presented the stunning facts. A few light years away, it announced, the sun appears as a bright star, and the planets are not visible. A few dozen light years away, the sun is not visible either to the naked eye. And at that distance, a few dozen light years is only about 1,000th part of the distance from the sun to the center of our galaxy, one galaxy which itself contains about 200 billion suns, and is, in turn, one of millions, perhaps billions of galaxies, innumerable repetitions, innumerable variations. All this rolled past my head, too, like balls of lightning. Now realism was abandoned for familiar artifice. A model of the solar system was spinning away in its elegant style. A bright bug took off from the Earth, heading for Jupiter. I set my dodging and shrinking mind sternly to recording facts. The mass of Jupiter, 2.5 times that of the other planets put together. The great red spot, 13 moons. Past Jupiter, a glance at the eccentric orbit of Pluto, the icy rings of Saturn, back to Earth, and moving into hot and dazzling Venus. Atmospheric pressure 90 times ours. Moonless Mercury rotating 3 times while circling the sun twice. An odd arrangement, not as satisfying as the old one, for once. No perpetual darkness, after all. Why did they give out such confident information, only to announce later that it was quite wrong? Finally, the picture already familiar from magazines, the red soil of Mars, the blooming pink sky. When the show was over, I sat in my seat while the children clamored across me, making no comments on anything they had just seen or heard. They were pestering their keepers for eatables and further entertainments. An effort had been made to get their attention, to take it away from canned pop and potato chips and fix it on various knowns and unknowns and horrible immensities. And it seemed to have failed. A good thing, too, I thought. Children have a natural immunity, most of them, and it shouldn't be tampered with. As for the adults who would deplore it, the ones who promoted this show, weren't they immune themselves to the extent that they could put in the echo chamber effects, the music, the church-like solemnity, simulating the awe that they supposed they ought to feel? Awe. What was that supposed to be? A fit of the shivers when you looked out the window? Once you knew what it was, you wouldn't be courting it. Two men came with brooms to sweep up the debris the audience had left behind. They told me that the next show would start in 40 minutes. In the meantime, I had to get out. I went to the show at the planetarium, I said to my father. It was very exciting, about the solar system. I thought, what a false and silly word I had used, exciting. It's like a slightly phony temple, I added. He was already talking. I remember when they found Pluto. Right where they thought it had to be. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, he recited. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. Is that right? Yes, I said. I was just as glad he hadn't heard what I said about the phony temple. I had meant that to be truthful, but it sounded slick and superior. Tell me the moons of Jupiter. Well, I don't know the new ones. There's a bunch of new ones, isn't there? Two, but they're not new. New to us, said my father. You've turned pretty cheeky now I'm going under the knife. Under the knife? What an expression. He was not in bed tonight, his last night. He had been detached from his apparatus and was sitting in a chair by the window. He was bare-legged, wearing a hospital dressing gown, but he did not look self-conscious or out of place. He looked thoughtful but good-humored, an affable host. You haven't even named the old ones, I said. Give me time. Galileo named them. Lo, that's a star. The moons of Jupiter were the first heavenly bodies discovered with the telescope. He said this gravely, as if he could see the sentence in an old book. It wasn't Galileo named them either. It was some German. Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, there you are. Yes. Io and Europa, they were girlfriends of Jupiter's, weren't they? Ganymede was a boy, a shepherd. I don't know who Callisto was. I think she was a girlfriend, too, I said. Jupiter's wife, Jove's wife, changed her into a bear and stuck her up in the sky. Great Bear and Little Bear. Little Bear was her baby. The loudspeaker said that it was time for visitors to go. I'll see you when you come out of the anesthetic, I said. Yes. When I was at the door, he called to me. Ganymede wasn't any shepherd. He was Jove's cupbearer. When I left the planetarium that afternoon, I had walked through the museum to the Chinese garden. I saw the stone camels again, the warriors, the tomb. I sat on a bench looking toward Bloor Street. Through the evergreen bushes and the high-grilled iron fence, I watched people going by in the late afternoon sunlight. The planetarium show had done what I'd wanted it to after all. Calmed me down. Drained me. I saw a girl who reminded me of Nicola. She wore a trench coat and carried a bag of groceries. She was shorter than Nicola. Not really much like her at all, but I thought that I might see Nicola. She would be walking along some street maybe not far from here. Burdened, preoccupied, alone. She was one of the grown-up people in the world now, one of the shoppers going home. If I did see her, I might just sit and watch, I decided. I felt like one of those people who have floated up to the ceiling, enjoying a brief death, a relief while it lasts. My father had chosen, and Nicola had chosen. Someday, probably soon, I would hear from her. But it came to the same thing. I meant to get up and go over to the tomb, to look at the relief carvings, the stone pictures that go all the way around it. I always mean to look at them, and I never do. Not this time either. It was getting cold out, so I went inside to have coffee and something to eat, before I went back to the hospital. And now, from the personal history section of the April 4th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Lucky Go Happy. The America I saw while on tour in the fall of 2021 was weary and battle-scarred. Its sidewalks were cracked, its mailboxes bashed in. By David Sedaris. Throughout the worst of the pandemic, I, like everyone, thought of the many things I'd failed to appreciate back when life was normal. Oh, to be handed an actual restaurant menu, to stand so close to a stranger that you can read the banal text messages that are obviously more important to him than his toddler stumbling off the curb and out into traffic. Many felt that they had taken their jobs for granted, but not me. I always loved my work. Or at least the part of it that was public and involved reading out loud. The last show I did before COVID-19 robbed me of my livelihood was in Vancouver, British Columbia, in a theater I didn't care much for, a rock house with a grim, cramped lobby and the sort of dressing room you see in movies about performers who overdose on drugs because their dressing rooms are so depressing. The audience was lovely, though, and I liked my hotel, which, at the end of the day, is really what it's all about. I'm never the one paying for the room, so I'm spared the part where you lie awake and wonder if it's really worth $600 or $700 or $800 just so someone can creep in while you're out and arrange a pair of slippers beside your freshly turned down bed. They're on the carpet and look as if they belong to a wealthy ghost who's just scooted over to make room for you. In the restaurant of my Vancouver hotel the following morning, I sat beside a handsome actor it took me no time at all to recognize. On the television series I had most recently watched him in, he was quick-tempered and physically abusive, so I liked how polite he was to the waiter and to the woman who floated away with his empty orange juice glass. Gee, thanks. That's very kind of you. As I boarded the elevator back to my room, the hotel manager stepped in and asked me how my stay was going. Terrific, I told him. I just saw a big star in the restaurant. Oh, I can't confirm that, the fellow said, offering a stiff smile. Well, I don't need you to, I told him, offering a smile of my own. I know perfectly well who it was. And then I couldn't remember the guy's name for the life of me. Oh, you know, I said to my friend Adam, who produces a good number of my events and who rode with me to the airport an hour or so after I'd finished my breakfast. It's what's-his-name who's on that TV series with the woman who used to be married to the guy who made that movie with a song in it that everybody knows. Aside from my star sighting, my last show was pretty typical. I read something new and realized it didn't work as well as I'd hoped. Then I signed books for 3 hours. The evening was unremarkable. A shame, because for the next year and a half I would reflect upon it obsessively. Would almost fetishize it. That was what I used to do for a living, I'd think, and now it's over. On the best days, I'd remind myself that everyone was sitting at home, that this was just a temporary setback. A part of me worried, though, that when the world would eventually move on, it would do so without me, or at least without any particular need of me. The circus would take to the road again, but not with this elephant. I decided from the start of the pandemic not to get Zoom. What do you mean, get it, my boyfriend Hugh asked. It's nothing you have to buy or attach to your computer. You press a button and wham, it's there. Well, can you mark which button, I asked. I want to make sure I never push it. In the course of the next 18 months, I did do one Zoom event, though it wasn't on my computer. Instead, someone came to the apartment and I used his. How'd it go? My lecture agent asked me when it was over. I have no idea, I told him, and it was true. Without a live audience, that fail-safe congregation of unwitting editors, I'm lost. It's not just their laughter I pay attention to, but also the quality of their silence. As for noises, a groan is always good, in my opinion. A cough means that if they were reading this passage on the page, they'd be skimming now, and a snore is your brother-in-law putting a gun to your head and pulling the trigger. You are dead now. The evening is over. I wrote during the pandemic. I published things, which is scary, as without a public reading, I had no idea whether they actually worked or not. I can occasionally try something out on Hugh, but not for long. At most, he'll listen for a minute or so before turning away and saying he'd rather read whatever it is himself, and only after the book or magazine comes out in print. "Yes, but by then it'll be too late to make changes," I tell him. Hugh and I have vastly different senses of humor. This is to say that I have one and he doesn't. What I need him for are his comments. "You can't say that," he'll insist on the odd chance I make it past my opening sentence. "Disgusting" is another one of his favorites. Hugh saying, "That's terrible," is a sure sign that an audience will laugh. One of my many nicknames for him is Congressman Prude, and for good reason. "I just don't see the need for that language," he'd sniff, referring on one occasion to the term bare bottom, and on another to ovaries. "Do you have to talk that way?" To be on tour was to hear, at least 10 times a day, "You must be exhausted." People would insist that what I was going through was grossly unfair, too much to ask of a mortal human, and just as I'd find myself agreeing, I'd think, "Hold on. All I've actually done this morning is eat breakfast, take an hour-long flight from Atlanta to Birmingham. That's not at all exhausting. There were days, certainly, when it was stressful. Flights would be canceled and alternatives hastily configured, but it wasn't me doing the configuring. Rather, it was a travel agent, a professional. I'd see hotheads in those long customer service lines, the ones in which every passenger required a full half hour of phone calls and concentrated keyboard pecking. But since I outsourced the drama to someone else, even with a hectic rerouting, I couldn't really complain. I flew a dozen or so times during the worst of the pandemic, to North Carolina, to Indiana and Kentucky, to the UK. It pained me to see the airport so empty. A majority of the businesses shuttered, the lounges closed. Walking through the terminal at Charlotte Douglas one afternoon in the summer of 2020, I came upon what looked to be a fig lying on the floor in a near-empty concourse. On closer inspection, I saw that it was a turd, a dog's most likely. "What has this world come to?" I thought. It was like seeing my office in ruins. The airport was my place. I knew its rhythms and its rules, could tell the professional travelers from the novices the moment they stepped from their cars, the latter with their spongy neck pillows holding up the TSA screenings. I knew I couldn't go through with water, but Sprite too? Of course, I'd be in pre-check, not inconvenienced by the novices, but incensed nevertheless. I guess you don't realize how good it feels to look down on someone until you've both indiscriminately been kicked to the curb. I couldn't wait to be back on my high horse and got the opportunity finally in the fall of 2021. My lecture agent had lined up a 72-city tour that was set to begin in the second week of September. My old life back, sort of. There would be restrictions. In the states that allowed such things, the audience would have to show proof of vaccination, and everyone would be masked. I tried not to get my hopes up too high, but at the same time, I needed to be prepared in case things went my way. If the elephant was indeed going back out with the circus, he needed to be a little bit less of an elephant. I'd gained a good 20 pounds in the past year and a half and would have to lose them if I was going to fit into my tour clothes. The diet I came up with involved walking 15 miles a day, eating half the amount that I normally do, and filling up as much sugar-free Jell-O as I wanted. People asked, "What flavor?" But there are no flavors, just colors, red, green, yellow, orange, and a new beige one that tastes beige. It was crazy how quickly I lost the weight. Every other week, I was taking my belt to the cobbler and having another hole punched. At first, he was all, "Congratulations," and then it was, "You again?" I was just grateful that he recognized me, as I felt that I looked so much older now. "I think it's your clothes that are the giveaway," Hugh said. And it's true. Think White House-era Harry Truman dressed like White House-era Dolly Madison. 2 days before my tour was to begin, the first city canceled owing to fears about the Delta variant. I worried the others would fall like dominoes, but the second, Nashville, held. How thrilling it was to be in front of an audience again, to expend energy and actually feel it reverberating back, to be in a nice hotel. I'd find over the coming 3 months that many of them had cut back on services. A daily room cleaning now had to be specifically asked for, ostensibly for COVID reasons, but really because there were so few housekeepers. In city after city, all I saw were help wanted signs. If McDonald's was offering $14 an hour, the Taco Bell next door was willing to pay $16. Every Starbucks was hiring, every drugstore and supermarket. Had the people who used to work there died, I wonder? Where was everyone? When teenagers came to my book signing table, my first question was no longer, when did you last see your parents naked, but do you have a job? 9 times out of 10, before the kid could speak, his or her mother would take over. Tyler's too busy with his schoolwork, or Kayla just needs to be 17 now. On several occasions, the person was genderqueer, and the mother would say, Cedar is taking some time off to figure themselves out. There was a willow as well, and a hickory. I guessed that was a thing now, naming yourself after a tree. One woman I met, a mother of three, told me that none of her teenagers held jobs and weren't likely to anytime soon. Why should they bust their butts for $17 an hour? Because it's 17 more than they get by sitting at home doing nothing? I grew up having to work and don't want to put my kids in that headspace, the woman said. Dear God, I thought, America as I knew it is finished. Aren't you supposed to have an awful job when you're a teenager? It's how you develop a sense of compassion. My sister Gretchen and I both worked in cafeterias, and Amy was a supermarket cashier. Tiffany worked in kitchens, Paul too. I made $1.60 an hour, and damn it, I was happy to get it. That's the way this country ran. If at age 16 you wanted a bong, you went out there and worked for it. Now I guess your parents just buy it for you and probably give you the pot as well. Toward the end of my tour, the Times ran an article about the many schools that were instituting virtual Fridays. Parents were up in arms, as now they'd have to find sitters or stay at home themselves that day. Well, I think it's much needed, said every teacher I spoke to. Our jobs are really stressful. Everyone was saying that now. Being a claims adjuster, heading an IT unit, publicizing eyeshadow. It's hard work that takes a real toll on me. Because it was so difficult to find and maintain staff, people who 2 years earlier might have been fired for one reason or another were still at their posts. The desk clerk at one hotel I stayed in, for instance. I arrived shortly after midnight and found the place deserted. Not a soul in the lobby. Hello, I called. Is anybody there? When no one answered, I took a step behind the check-in desk and I tried again. Hello! I walked to the bell stand and back. I peered into the restaurant, which was closed off with a louvered metal gate. A few more minutes passed, and just as I was wondering if I should call a cab and try some other hotel, a woman appeared, mid-40s, slightly disheveled and angry. Her mouth was small and looked like a recently healed exit wound. What are you doing? She demanded. You're not supposed to step behind my counter, especially now in COVID times. We can't have people back here. I'm sorry, I said. There was no one around, and I wasn't sure. We know you're here, the woman snapped. We got cameras. We can see you. Well, I've never worked in a hotel, I thought. How am I supposed to know your setup? If you saw me, why didn't you come out? I asked. I was busy, she said. Is that okay with you, me doing stuff? She'd clearly been lying down. The only question was, had she been alone or with someone else? This wasn't some flop house that rented rooms by the hour. My one night was costing close to $200, but even if it were one-tenth that price, you can't talk to your guests like that, at least not when they're being reasonably polite. I decided that on my way out the following morning I was going to tell on this woman, but when the time came and her associate asked, how was your stay, I said simply, fine, thinking, as I always do when someone is rude to me, at least I can write about it. The America I saw in the fall of 2021 was weary and battle-scarred. Its sidewalks were cracked, its mailboxes bashed in. All along the West Coast I saw tent cities. They were in parks, in vacant lots, in dilapidated squares. In one stop after another, I'd head to a store or restaurant I remembered and find it boarded up or maybe burned out.
the plywood that blocked the doors covered with graffiti, Black Lives Matter, Eat the Rich, F the Police. During my year and a half at home, I had forgotten about the ups and downs of life on tour. One night you're at Symphony Hall, and the next in a worn-out, once-grand movie theater that is now overrun by mice. Can you believe they wanted to tear this place down? The house manager invariably asked, fondly looking up at a gold plaster cherub with one arm missing. Yes, as a matter of fact. Whenever the extremes got to me, I'd comfort myself with the many interesting people I met as I made my way across the country. A woman, for instance, whose father had executed her pet hamster with a .22 rifle. But why, I asked. Butterscotch had a virus that caused all her hair to fall out, she told me. The most haunting person was one I never met face to face. In the middle of my tour, I was to fly from Springfield, Missouri, to Chicago, where I would have a night off. I arrived at the airport early, checked my bag, and was walking outdoors, getting some steps in. When I received the message at my flight that all flights to Chicago had been canceled. And so I asked if a car could possibly be arranged. One was, and while I waited for it to arrive, I retrieved my bag and got some more steps in. Because I had to keep an eye on my luggage, I couldn't go far. So I walked circles around the baggage carousels, none of which were in use. Passing one of them, I saw, huddled in its gutter, two pairs of soiled panties, a nearly empty Tic Tac dispenser, a brush with strands of long strawberry blonde hair caught in it, three AA batteries, and a little sheaf of toothpicks. It was such an interesting portrait of someone, a young woman, I assumed. And I thought of her for months to come, wondering as I moved from place to place in this divided, beat-up country of ours, where she was and what she imagined had become of her panties. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.